What does it mean to be truly educated? Sylvia Plath once said, "Everything in life is writable about if you have the outgoing guts to do it and the imagination to improvise. The worst enemy to creativity is self-doubt." If the purpose of writing is to do something bold and creative, does formal writing instruction typically used in schools help learners achieve this? Well, actually, the purpose of formulaic writing is to help students pass mandated state writing assessments, and I, for one, have never been inspired by any five-paragraph essay. So, how do we help students become writers with guts and imagination? John Warner is a writer, speaker, teacher, and author of the book, Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay, and Other Necessities. As a teacher of writing, he emphasizes the author's voice and he views writing as a tool to help solve problems and causes prompts, writing problems. In this episode of Beyond the Curriculum, I have the pleasure to learn about how John helps students discover the writer within by moving students away from formulas and think beyond the curriculum. You know, you mentioned bringing kids to proficiency, and that's what formulaic writing is all about, is creating this model of proficiency. At what point in your career did you realize that formulaic writing destroys writers?
What I saw from students coming into my first year writing classes was not a sort of deficit of skills, but a decline in spirit. Their attitudes they brought towards writing were troubling. They just didn't see any place for themselves in writing. Writing was something you did for school, you did it for a teacher, you did it for this standard of proficiency. And it was so alien to how I experienced writing as a writer and teacher of writing, which was this form of empowerment. This is like how I figure out the world. I literally use writing to think. And they weren't doing that. At the same time, I was realizing that while I had always sort of disdained the formulaic nature of the five-paragraph essay, what I had primarily done in my classes was create much more elaborate versions of it. I was telling myself, this is what they need to do in order to produce a quality artifact, right? The assignment itself. And they would go to this next assignment, and I would realize that very little of what they had done on the previous one was transferring. And then I would get to the research paper at the end of the semester where I thought we had been building to it all semester, and I would see all of the things, issues that they had entered my class with as a first-year writing course, were still present, a sort of regression. And I just had to start asking why this was, and I realized it was because I was not allowing them to wrestle with the sorts of problems writers have to wrestle with.
Yeah. So you've read a lot of student work over the years, and you've seen good writing, you've seen bad writing, you know, and everything in between. So what is good writing, and why is it important for people to learn to write well?
Yeah. So good writing is effective writing. They don't just write for the teacher. Part of being a good writer is ultimately being able to tailor your piece of writing to your audience, your purpose, and your message, and to influence them. In depending on the different kinds of course, but in when I teach fiction writing, I use essentially a one-point rubric, and the question I ask students to assess their own work and each other's is, does this story have energy? And early on, they ask, well, what do you mean by energy? I'm like, It means what it means. Just read for now. And they get it. It's sort of like, does this particular story at any point or maybe throughout make you like sit up in your chair and read it closer and get your heart beating and this kind of stuff? And then if they say yes, I ask them to identify where the energy comes from. Is it the plot? Is it the character? Is it the language? Is it some sort of stunning metaphor that just moved you? Whatever it may be, all that matters in a piece of fiction, at least this is how I respond to fiction, is energy. So when we think about, is it good writing? It's like, does it Does it embody and inhabit the characteristics that allow an audience to respond to it?
Yeah. If the point of good writing is to move somebody, how do you measure that movement?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to move everybody differently.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
How do you measure that? And
I was much more progressive in teaching creative writing, fiction writing. And in hindsight, I'm like, what were you thinking? Why did you see these as different? But in creative writing, it was always, were you moved? Did something happen to you emotionally?
Well, there's a lot of nonfiction works that are out there that I read because they move me. Books like like yours, like Why They Can't Write, I enjoyed it. It moved me. But Malcolm Gladwell's catalog, White Rage, moved me. There's some amazing books out there. And the whole purpose of these nonfiction books is to move, because when we're moved, we feel inspired to take action.
Mm-hmm. 100%. 100%.
So how have the use of more authentic writing problems, and I love that you call them writing problems rather than prompts or something like that. So how has the use of more authentic writing problems helped transform your classroom and your students' writing?
Yeah, so these are always rooted in the rhetorical purpose of message, audience, and purpose, the rhetorical situation. And they are these writing-related problems where you have to do something. You have to achieve an objective for an authentic audience. So an experience early on in the writer's practice is students have to write a review. They can write a review of anything they want. It could be a movie, a TV show, a album, showing my age using record album as a term, but an album, an app, a restaurant, a coffee shop, what have you. And it immediately forces them to solve a problem that they recognize because they've read these things forever. Mm. And so they have to, I've taught reviews for many, many, many years, but it wasn't until I kind of switched my orientation where I stopped telling them what's in a review and instead go get some reviews and figure out what sorts of things are in them. And students will begin to notice lots of different things. They'll notice that some reviews have very definitive verdicts. They notice that some reviews are more like, well, if you like this sort of thing, it might be good. If you like that sort of thing, you might not like it so much. They understand structure, and they start to notice things like a movie review. This one sort of stands out from class, where they brought in a review where the review started with something like, I'm normally not a fan of Ryan Gosling, but his work in La La Land was delightful, something like that. Mm. And the students sort of note this, like, well, why would you start a review that way? What's up with that? And they'll say things like, oh, the reviewer's confessing their bias. And I'll try to steer them away from bias just because I think it's a loaded word for them. And they've often been conditioned to believe you're supposed to be objective, which I think is a problem in and of itself. I say, well, bias, okay, but it's more like, let's just call it position. This is the reviewer's position. They are not a reflexive Ryan Gosling fan. A reviewer who said, I will watch anything Ryan Gosling appears in, is a different sort of reviewer. And they begin to say, like, oh, the audience wants to know where I'm coming from, right? Like, if I'm reviewing a pizza place and, you know, any pizza is good. It could be great pizza. It could be 3-day-old pizza that's been sitting on the coffee table. It's all good to me. That's the sort of thing an audience should know to make their own judgment. So by solving these problems, they're having a much deeper engagement, not only with their own writing, but with the things they're reading in the world. They're beginning to unpack them, to read like a writer reading. And so then in the end, we're having this writing experience where the review itself, the things students write under this approach, are about as accomplished as they were when I had a highly, highly prescriptive approach, where I'd say the opening of a review does this, you need to cover these points, you need to end with a recommendation of some kind, et cetera, et cetera. the writing is no better or worse, but they've had this experience of trying to solve the problem where we then can go back and reflect on it.
Yeah. Well, in Why They Can't Write, you have so many fun writing problems. And one of them I've kind of transformed. You do, you ask the question whether a hot dog is a sandwich. I do in my class, I've done this for a couple years now. Does pineapple belong on pizza? And it's a last school year, it got
passionate, I'm sure. Oh my goodness.
And it was a year-long thing. I mean, it did not end. And like in May, I had one of my students say, that's it. She called up the local pizza place and asked them, does pineapple? And the kid that answered it, she had him on speakerphone. The kid that answered it said, no, it's disgusting. And the class just lit up.
An appeal to authority. It's a, you know, it's a totally legit method of argumentation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, it's a fantastic idea that really doesn't mean anything, but really challenges kids in their thinking and defending their positions. But you have so many great ideas in your book, Why They Can't Write. But one of the things that I loved the most was transforming writing through having kids writing op-eds rather than having the 5-paragraph essay. Because in your book, you state that most of our 5-paragraph essays start with a thesis, but most op-eds end with a thesis. Mm-hmm. So I would like you to walk me through the op-ed. How do you teach your students to write an op-ed?
So this is born of very standard first-year writing, academic writing exercises of summary and response, where you are asked to summarize the source's argument as best you can in their own, without any skew, right? With this is what somebody else is claiming, and then respond with an argument of your own. And I used to dutifully teach these modes, the summary and response. It would take a couple of weeks, and we would do all the peer review and this kind of stuff. And I would like, great, we now can summarize sources using claim verbs, and we're ready to move on to more sophisticated stuff. And then I would move on to an experience or assignment where they were supposed to use this underlying skill of summary and response, and it was as though we had never done it. Uh-huh. It had disappeared. So I had started building in like extra assignments, like bonus assignments as I was iterating towards a grading contract. And one of them was to read an existing op-ed in like the New York Times and then write a comment on the Times website, New York Times website. And they would have to summarize the argument. This is what I get from this particular op-ed, and then offer an argument of their own. And I realized this is summary and response. And I'm reading this, the stuff the students had written, in many cases had written in 20 minutes, 30 minutes. They had read it. They had, they were going to get credit if they just posted a comment. And they were better than the things I had spent 2 weeks doing, teaching summary and response. And so I realized, like, why not just let them do this? Why not just let them make arguments about things they care about in the way an op-ed does? So I would start them by doing versions of summary and response op-eds. Take somebody else's argument and then either agree or disagree or some mixture of both. And by allowing them to choose, right, they have to sort of choose the source they're going to work from, the op-ed they're going to work from. By allowing them to choose that and letting them have their own opinion and argue from it, they're allowed to engage with it in ways that my summary and response exercise, where we're all reading the same thing and responding to the same thing, a purely mechanical exercise, it just had a much richer engagement with the text. And then after that, they can just write their own from their own topic. So it's really It's about having the writing experience. So it's about setting the goal. Here's what we want you to do. Here's your audience. Here is your objective. And you get to craft your message and you get to choose your subject and you get to write something that's meaningful. Like you could write your op-ed about whether or not pineapple is an appropriate ingredient for a pizza, if you so desire. And I bet you probably had some students who could write some very good op-eds on that.
Yeah.
What I discovered is with much less instruction, quote unquote, with me doing much less, students were doing and experiencing much more because I had given them this authentic problem, authentic audience, authentic situation, and they get it. And it's just sort of instantly better, quote unquote. In the sense that the writing is more interesting, it's clear that they're more engaged, they're spending more time on it. It's clear that they're wrestling with the problem as writers do, as opposed to, here's my template for how an op-ed is structured, fill in each box. Instead, they're having the organic experience of what all writers do, which is you start writing on a subject and you think you knew what you wanted to say. But after 500, 600, 700 words, you have an epiphany to yourself and realize that you had a different thing to say all the time. And there it is at the end. This is the struggle. And an op-ed is a good, straightforward experience.
Yeah. Now, I know you teach fiction writing and I know you teach first year writing and some lit classes, but let's say you were to transition into a social studies or a science class. How could you use this form of op-ed writing within science or social studies?
Well, it's if writing is thinking, you can have them write about any subject in any way, in any context. So in the writer's practice, I actually have a assignment that I call an alternate history assignment, where they have to sort of choose anything in history and then spin out what would have happened. And you could adapt something like that to an op-ed, right? Mm-hmm. As a history exercise. The example I use in the book is I illustrate with the example of the Bulls drafting Michael Jordan. He had a transformative effect on the NBA and basketball and all this kind of stuff. But he also had a transformative effect on the city of Chicago. And you could write an op-ed arguing that Michael Jordan led to the gentrification of the West Side of Chicago. That's a history. So you can have them write about any subject in any kind of argument around these things, and writing for an authentic audience that's interested in it. So the op-ed is highly flexible because it's an argument, right? You're trying to convince an audience of what you have to say is accurate and true. You could do science. I taught a version of first year writing that was for all biology majors. It was a learning community. And we simply did the same exercise around scientific issues. You know, learning the material in the biology class in the context of expressing some original idea about what they're learning in biology for a general audience while making an argument. So there's really no boundary around it. Writing is thinking.
Right.
So if you want them to think about history or think as historians do or think as scientists do, biologists do, chemists do, simply craft a writing-related problem or writing experience with that authentic audience for an argument around those subjects. Students have very little trouble grasping what you're asking them to do in these cases because they get it. They live in the world. They have ideas. They have thoughts. They have beliefs. And all you're asking them to do is express and articulate those beliefs with a specific purpose in mind.
Right. So what resources would you steer listeners to help them build more, besides your books, obviously?
Of course.
Yeah, of course, your books, which definitely, pick up Why They Can't Write, But what resources would you recommend listeners to pick up in order to help them build more authentic writing models for their classrooms?
One book I recommend, and it's open source, so it's free, which is even better. It's called Bad Ideas About Writing. And it's an edited collection of lots of different writing teachers. And the conceit is that we take these things we think we know about writing and turn them on their heads. So we take a bad idea about writing, like writing must involve a 5-paragraph structure. And they show how that then becomes a bad idea. So it's sort of all of these things, the things students arrive in my class with, like never use I, contractions aren't allowed, these sorts of things. It breaks them down and forces you to think about them. So even bad ideas about writing, rather than being prescriptive about how to teach, is a demonstration of how to think about what you're going to do in class. There's another book coming out that I enthusiastically endorsed called Creating Confident Writers for High School, College, and Life by Troy Hicks and Andy Shainborn. And it's just a very good, practical framework for thinking about how to teach writing. It has some assignments and that sort of stuff, but it's more like here's a way of looking at writing that can help create what the authors say, confident writers. The other resources I recommend is just to try to find a community of like-minded teachers. I spent many years in my career feeling like I was alone in how I was feeling about these things. I was experimenting in ways that felt illicit and secret. And once I sort of came out from undercover, I realized like, oh, there's not only a lot of people that believe this who I share a hallway with in the offices, but in the wider world, like Aaron Blackwell. I mean, there's, you know, we've never met in person, but it's like all of a sudden, once you know you're not alone, that gives a certain amount of courage, I think, behind whatever experiments you want to do, and a backstop where you can float ideas. And to me, this made a tremendous amount of difference. The courage to write these writing books came from the community of other people who were doing similar things. And to realize like, oh man, there's thousands of people out there, but certainly not alone. And that makes a huge difference. So in terms of resources, other people who are in the struggle are invaluable, or have been to me.
Good writing has a purpose. It inspires, connects, and causes readers to reflect and feel. Good writing also comes through struggle. Some of the best pieces of literature reflect the struggles experienced by the writer, and these struggles resonate because we all struggle and want to know that no matter what, in the end, we will be okay. And as John suggests, when we do not allow learners to struggle, we do not allow them to experience what it truly is to be a writer. For more information about John, visit beyondthecurriculumpodcast.com and check out the show notes. There you will find links to the resources John recommends, along with a lesson plan that I've designed. Be sure to hit the subscribe button, as you'll want to catch every episode. And remember to leave a rating and review. I appreciate your support, and it helps people find the show. I encourage you to partner with me through my Patreon page. Your donation will help offset the cost of producing this podcast and bring more meaningful opportunities that take learners beyond the curriculum.